Good afternoon, and welcome to the January meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. A particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the Forum. Since 1985, the Forum has been having monthly meetings to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia, talk about the critical foreign policy questions facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very happy to have Nazila Fati, who is an Iranian who last year was actually up here on the Nieman Fellows weekend. At that point, she was a Nieman Fellow, and she came up here last May. She's been, before she became a Nieman Fellow, she had been working for the New York Times for over a decade, reporting from Tehran until June of 2009, when she was forced to leave the country. Before that, she had worked for AFP. She worked for Time Magazine. She's written for numerous publications, including the New York Review of Books and Foreign Policy. She also translated a book by the Iranian Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi called The History and Documentation of Human Rights in Iran. We are very lucky to have her here today, back up from Cambridge, where this spring she's a Shorenstein Fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Her talk today is Iran and its supreme leader 2 years after the contested election. Nazila.
Thank you very much. Hi, and thank you very much for having me here. It's very humbling to be here. I prefer not to stand there because this is too high. I feel nobody can see me anymore. I think we've been very lucky to be here on such a beautiful day, no snow. We were a little bit afraid when we initially planned this that we might get caught in a storm on the way here. We were planning to come earlier, but it's gorgeous, beautiful. And incidentally, I'm here at a very interesting time. I was just talking with a few people how 1 week there were talks about a possible military strike against Iran, and then just a few days ago, American army military were hugging Iranian fishermen who they saved from pirates in the Arabian Sea. Iran has been a country of such contrast for 30 years. It's been a riddle to us Iranians as well as to people outside the country. And to predict where this country is going or what happens, how its people react to different incidents has always been difficult to predict. Even like few days before the 1997 victory of the reformist president, nobody saw that coming. Everybody thought that the government would go to extraordinary lengths to bring in its own candidates, the favorite of the regime. And in 2009, nobody thought that the election would be stolen so brazenly and millions of people will pour out on the streets to protests and that it would continue for 6 months. But since 2 years ago, a little bit we have learned about the country and its leadership and who is behind the direction that is moving. The supreme leader went to extraordinary length to oppose what people were demanding, new elections. He's been very much in charge, both of the domestic decision-making and the foreign policy in the past 2 years. So I think it's important to see who this man is, what his goals are, and how he has changed. Why is he so adamantly against relations with the United States? There have been several opportunities that both countries could have improved ties. Why is he so persistent to continue with Iran's nuclear program, even though he says it's peaceful and is just aimed at producing energy. And why has he been so opposed to reforms inside the country? The man who we call Ayatollah Khamenei now, Ali Khamenei, he was the second son of a cleric in the city of Mashhad, northeastern Iran. His father sent him to a seminary. He wanted him to become a cleric. But when he went to the seminary, he became friends with poets and activists. People who knew him remember him as a man who liked poetry, who played the traditional instrument of tar. He smoked the pipe, and that's why people thought he was a moderate cleric. He was modern. He wore a watch. Many clerics were opposed to it. He became close to activists. He became a supporter and a follower of Ayatollah Khomeini, who was in exile then. He was sent into prison 6 times, but because the Shah was so against sending clerics into prison, he was sent into exile once to the southern city of Iran Shahr, where he met some of the people who later became his confidants. After the revolution, Khomeini appointed him to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. The council had 6 clerics. All 6 of them were appointed by Khomeini, and 9 other members who were military or secular figures. After the victory of the revolution and after the first president, Abul Hasan Bani Sa'd, was elected as president, he was appointed or imposed on the president as the Minister of Defense. When the war broke out, he was the man who was going to the areas in the south, meeting with commanders. And it was since those days that he started getting close to the military figures in the Revolutionary Guards and the army. After Bani Sa'd was sort of dismissed as president and he was forced to leave the country, the Islamists hijacked the revolution. The second president was killed, and he was elected as president. Khomeini was very much in charge, and so was Rafsanjani. Although Rafsanjani and Khomeini were very close, which is something that we learned from Rafsanjani's memoir, but Rafsanjani was the Speaker of Parliament, and together with Khomeini, they made most of the decisions. And Khomeini had a very ceremonial job. His prime minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi, who later, 30 years later, became the leader of the opposition movement, was the prime minister who was imposed on him. Several times he tried to dismiss him, but Khomeini and parliament, which was headed by Rafsanjani, opposed the decision. He was quite obedient. He performed his ceremonial job quite well. In 1986, at a Friday prayers speech, he expressed his objection to the prime minister, and he criticized Khamenei. He said that it was not right that one man had absolute power. Khomeini got very angry, and he embarrassed him in a public letter. He said that it was very obvious from his comments that he didn't know anything about a system that was based on velayat-e-faqih, the absolute rule of the jurisprudence. He said that he didn't like the fact that he had publicized internal rifts, and he was trying to interfere in decisions that they didn't have to do with him as a president. They were the jobs of a prime minister. Khamenei felt very, very embarrassed, and he did not express those kinds of comments anymore. After Khomeini's death, Rafsanjani stepped in to fill in the vacuum. He gave a speech at the Council of Experts, the council that was responsible for picking the next supreme leader, and he said that Khomeini had wanted Khamenei to replace him. And it seemed at that time it was such a good choice. Khamenei had not been very ambitious when he was president. He had never appeared as a very strong leader. And it seemed that most of the leadership at that time wanted somebody who would be in that position to serve as a ceremonial supreme leader. Decisions would be made by other sections. By that time, the position of prime minister had been abolished. Rafsanjani was running for president. The constitution had given more power to the president. And before Khomeini's death, the constitution had been amended, and the supreme leader was getting more power as well. So Khamenei was chosen as the supreme leader, the new Valiyev Faqih, the same position that Khamenei had, even though he did not have any of the religious credentials that he should have had. He was a mid-ranking cleric. They gave him the title of Ayatollah, but he never became the source of emulation that Khomeini was, the very supreme cleric. The first sign that he showed he was not going to be the quiet, obedient supreme leader was when he opposed to move into Khomeini's house office. Khomeini's house and office was practically one bedroom that comprised of a bed and nothing else. And his son, Ahmad, was his bureau chief. He did everything. It was a very, very traditional office. Khamenei refused to move there. He moved downtown, right next door to the president's office and parliament. And he set up a huge bureaucracy. And he did not pick his confidants from among well-known figures. Most of them were people he knew from the past. For example, his bodyguard became the man who was his driver for many years, the man who had driven him to hospital when he was injured in a bomb attack in 1981, during which he lost the working of his left arm. Or the man who became his link, the link between the Khamenei's office with the army and the Revolutionary Guards, was the man who was in exile with him in Iran Shah under the Shah. He made a bureaucracy with very, very specific divisions, exactly parallel to the ministries under the president's office. And by 1984, when Rafsanjani was elected for his second term, Khamenei had solidified his power. He had become a very powerful supreme leader who appointed the four main major ministries, the key ministries of defense, higher education, intelligence, and the interior ministry. He had four of the major ministries under his own thumb. By 1984, he introduced the notion of cultural invasion, even though Iran was not in a war anymore. I'm sorry, 1994. Even though Iran was not in a war with Iraq or any other outside country, he came up with this notion of cultural invasion that Iran has to constantly be in a defensive state to protect its revolutionary and religious values. Rafsanjani remained president until 1997, and his interior ministry was responsible for holding elections. By that time, Khamenei had made it clear that his choice for the next president was the Speaker of Parliament, Nader Nuri, who was a conservative figure close to Khamenei. And Mohammad Khatami, the more reformist figure, was running for president. Rafsanjani vowed to hold free elections, and perhaps that was the freest election that was ever held under the Islamic Republic. And Khatami was elected in an overwhelming victory. However, that was the time that Khamenei promised himself not to let such a thing happen anymore. In 1998, his ministry, a year after Khatami's election, was behind the killing of intellectuals. Khatami pursued the matter, and it became clear that the Ministry of Intelligence had been not only behind the killing of four or five intellectuals and dissidents, but about 80 people, and possibly behind the suspicious killing of Khomeini's son in 1991. By 1998, he was in charge of major, major decision-making centers. The Council of Guardian, which was responsible for screening candidates for any election. Six of its members were directly appointed by Khamenei. Six other members were appointed by the judiciary. The head of the judiciary was directly appointed by Khamenei. The head of state-run television and radio were directly appointed by Khamenei. Head of all the military commanders in the country were directly appointed by Khamenei, and he was in charge of all the religious and financial centers around the country. And it was since 1998, after the first major protest erupted around the country, that Khamenei came out. He cried on television. He said that he had a maimed body, but he was willing to give his life for the revolution. And he went out and he suppressed the protests. And after that, he started expanding the militia besiege force that was made of volunteers and the Revolutionary Guards. He began investing in the Revolutionary Guards and allowed them to enter into economics and be in charge of many of the major projects around the country. That continued until 2005. In 2005, he took no risks. No reformist candidate was allowed to run. The people, supporters of the regime, were mobilized to vote for Ahmadinejad. It didn't seem at that time that it was stealing the elections, but it was very much an election that was engineered by supporters of Khamenei. Rafsanjani, who was running for president, suffered a humiliating defeat. And in 2009, they went to extraordinary lengths to steal the elections very brazenly. When we look at Khamenei and Khomeini, they are similar in some ways and they are different in some ways. Both of them have been authoritarian. Khomeini was brutal. He went out there, killed thousands of people in 1988. A few months before the end of the war, he ordered the execution of more than 3,000 political prisoners who were in jail. They had all been tried. They had been given jail terms, but Khomeini ordered their executions. And his decisions were very much impulsive. When he gave the issued the death sentence for Salman Rushdie, a lot of people have wondered whether he really knew what was written in the book. On the contrary, Khamenei has been very thoughtful, very calculating. He has planned his goals are from years before he has implemented them, before people have realized where he wants to go. Is he as brutal as Khomeini? We don't know. I mean, he hasn't killed thousands of people, but many people have been killed. And maybe it's a different time. Maybe internet and the information revolution is not letting him to go to the same lengths that Khomeini could go. We didn't know about the number of people, the huge number of people who were executed in prisons until a few years after it happened. Even relatives of those who had been killed, they didn't know how many people were exactly killed. It seems that Khamenei sees himself very much in a position that he has to achieve two goals. First of all, this guy has changed. The man who was moderate, the man who loved music, poetry, novel, he came out and gave a decree that music was not Islamic, that it had to be banned. This man has changed. He sees himself in a different position. And it seems that now that he's the supreme leader, he sees himself responsible, first of all, for protecting the revolution. The 1979, the legacy of Khomeini and the revolution, the pillars that it was built upon. One of them was animosity with the United States, and the other was animosity with Israel. He's gone to extraordinary lengths to prevent any kind of improvement of ties with the United States. And this is a man who speaks his mind. He's not like Rafsanjani, who says one thing publicly and analysts should analyze what he meant or what was beyond the surface of his words. This is a man who comes out and says that the United States is the enemy. And when he gives a speech, he constantly refers to the word dushman in Persian, which means the enemy. If he wants to talk about Israel, he uses the word Zionist. So he's always warning about rapprochement with dushman, with the enemy. He knows that those pillars of the revolution can fall apart if there are any kind of rapprochement between the two countries. His other mission is to turn Iran into a superpower, at least in the region. And it seems like his insistence to pursue Iran's ambition with a nuclear program is very much in line with that. Whether it's weaponization or just the capability, or just the prestige, but it seems that he wants to carry on with it, no matter what the consequences are. Would he compromise? Khomeini did eventually compromise and end the war in 1988. He said that he was drinking the poison when he was ending the war. Would Khomeini be pushed in a corner and back down? So far, it doesn't look like it. I mean, he has turned it into a national issue. He has compared it with nationalization of oil in 1953, and even people who are opposed to the goals of the Islamic regime somehow see this as a matter of prestige. If you talk to people on the streets, even people who don't support the regime, and you ask them, what do you think about the nuclear program? Many people, the first thing that they say is that if we had nuclear capability, Saddam wouldn't have attacked. And we're talking about a bloody war that dragged on for many years, left many people killed, and Iranians felt very humiliated by that war because they thought they were the powerful Persian nation that were attacked by an Arab nation, and in the end, it was just humiliation for them, no victory. So the nuclear program has been turned into a matter of prestige that a lot of people think that if the regime backs down, it would be a big defeat for the country. But the two decisions that Khamenei has made in the past 2 years has sort of made him quite alienated. One of them was the suppression of the protests in 2009 and coming out to support Ahmadinejad. By doing that, he made himself the target of the attacks. Until then, many people somehow saw him above the foray. Sometimes he supported the reformists, and sometimes he supported the conservatives. He had not made his politics so clear to everyone. But since then, he made himself the target of the attacks. And those protests were a result of very, very deep frustration. The first protest broke out in 1999. They were just like 10,000 people out on the streets. But by 2009, 10 years later, the number of protests had reached 3 million people. And Khamenei refused to reach any kind of compromise. He went to any possible length to repress those protests. And now at this stage, Khamenei is the man that the majority of people see responsible, who opposes their demands for more democracy, more political and social openness. Secondly, his foreign policy has pushed Iran further and further in isolation. And the recent sanctions are making people very disenchanted with the status quo. And it seems like his decisions to alienate some of the veteran politicians, diplomats, is even pushing Iran into further isolation. A few days before the attack on the British embassy in Tehran, Khamenei gave a speech, and he said that instead of being defensive, Iran was going to become more offensive. And many analysts thought that was the first sign that he gave that Iran would start making decisions like the attack on the British embassy. Not many people believe that the attack on the British embassy was just a spontaneous action by a bunch of students. First of all, they were not students. Secondly, it seemed that it was very organized. The police, the riot police, stood back and watched as it was happening. And then came the threat to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, which is not clear whether Iran has the military capability to do that or if it's willing to go to that length. Iran was not able to shut down the Strait of Hormuz even during the war when it was attacking the ships that were going through it. It doesn't have so many even mines to shut it down, and perhaps if it does try to do that, it can trigger a military strike or a war. But that lack of diplomacy, that lack of wisdom, whether Iran is really making those kinds of threats or is willing to go to those lengths to trigger a war is raising a lot of speculations among people inside the country. But Khamenei has maintained his rhetoric. He is still focusing on the besieged and the Revolutionary Guards as his main tools, both to protect the regime inside the country and outside the country. The Revolutionary Guards has become very, very powerful. Many of the former members of the Revolutionary Guards or current members are members of parliament now. The Minister of Oil, who was nominated and approved by parliament just a few months ago, is a prominent member of the Revolutionary Guards. And the economic influence and political influence of the Revolutionary Guards has just increased dramatically in the country. There has never been a time in Iran's history that the military force has had so much influence. And I would like to end with a couple of Khamenei's tweets. He has been one of the early Twitters in the country. I just want to give you a sense of how he comes across to Iranians, the Persian speakers, when we listen to him. This is a man that we believe he speaks his mind. His speeches are constantly filled with warning against the enemy, which refers to the United States. Warning that the Islamic and religious values should be protected, and the value that he gives to the besieged and the Revolutionary Guards. It was the Women's Week last week in Tehran, so he has made a couple of comments about the status of a woman in Islam. Progress cannot be achieved in society in the absence of families, and of course, a woman's value is related to a family, not beyond that. Families need pious and understanding of women. Iran's leader attended a discussion with scholars and experts on the issue of women and family. So a woman does not have a value outside the family to him. But before that, before the Women's Week, Ayatollah Khamenei meets with thousands of besieged forces. Western efforts to suppress the Middle East movements are futile. He has been talking very much about the Islamic Revolution, how it's been an inspiration to other countries in the region, how it is a model to the Egyptian and the Tunisian revolutions, and that it's a kind of Islamic awakening. Ayatollah Khamenei, on Western accusations regarding Iran's involvement in the Middle East uprisings, we don't need such things. Iran's leader, the slogan of the people in Egypt and Tunisia are being repeated in New York, California, Occupy Wall Street. Ayatollah Khamenei attends a meeting with thousands of besieged forces in Tehran again. Iran's commander-in-chief meets with Navy commanders. Navy will respond to foreign threats in a glorious way. Thank you.
That's great. It's very enlightening. It sounds like he's a more difficult person than we were even aware of.
I think so.
So the first question is, we've got a whole bunch of questions coming up, but the first question is, what should the United States policy be towards him from a diplomatic point of view? Is there any, as you recall, at the beginning of his term, President Obama tried to open up avenues of diplomacy towards Iran. Some people say he didn't do enough. Others say it was rejected out of hand and there's nothing we can do. What's your view? Is there anything the United States can do to sort of create something closer to rapprochement?
I agree that President Obama tried very hard to reach out to Iran. In early 2009, he sent a letter, and Khamenei responded to that letter publicly. I think Obama said that he was reaching a hand of friendship,
right.
And Khamenei responded that this hand is a fist, or there's a fist hidden under a glove, something like that. But then the protest broke out. It was a very tricky time. And even though I personally thought, and I know a lot of advocates thought that the best way to deal with Khamenei was to sort of put him in a position that he would give into improvement of ties. But with the protests, it seemed that engagement with a regime that was so brutally cracking down on its own people and on their pro-democratic demands was unfair, and it was sort of legitimizing a government that was not democratically elected. I'm not a diplomat. It's a very, very tricky position. But all I know is that the sanctions are not going to undermine him or the Revolutionary Guards in the short term, but they will undermine the civil society.
So just as a follow-up to that, do you think, in other words, we should back off from the economic sanctions?
Yes.
Okay. Here's two questions which I'll put together which sort of relate exactly to that. Should we have patience and wait for the Iranian regime to disintegrate, or is there some way we can help it disintegrate?
Well, I think sanctions or any kind of radical military attack will not help it disintegrate. It will solidify it. It will make it more defensive and now more offensive. I think Iranian regime is rotten from within. During the 2009 uprising, there were children of the very royal members of the leadership who were constantly being arrested. It was publicized. The son of one of them, a commander, was brutally killed in prison. And it seemed like the leadership wanted to give a message to the fathers of all these people that if you cannot contain your children, this is what's going to happen.
How about the Arab Spring? Is that likely to benefit Iran? Will it bring the Arab world closer to Iran or have no particular impact?
Well, I think it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen in the Arab world. Arab world is still struggling with where it will lead to, what kind of path it will have. In terms of whether it had any kind of influence on Iranian civil society, I don't think so. But I think it has threatened the Iranian regime. I mean, the fact that people's will is defining the future of these countries is a very scary notion. And it was after what happened in Tunisia and Egypt that the Iranian regime became even more repressive. It shut down a lot of internet freedom, arrested many more activists. So I think Iranian regime, despite its rhetoric, has been quite threatened by what happened.
A couple of questions about Iranian minorities. One is, why is the Baha'i religion singled out in Iran? And the other one is, what's the story as to why the Iran seems to have a policy of continuing to allow Iranian Jews to stay there and not be discriminated against?
Well, the Iranian constitution after the revolution recognized three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Zoroastrianism as legal, as the people of the book. Mm-hmm. So it has never opposed any of these religious minorities as long as they were not politicized. But it has been against Baha'is right from the outset of the revolution. Many of its members were jailed and executed, and for some reason it feels very, very threatened by the Baha'is. It doesn't even allow their children to attend higher education. If they, write down when they are filling out the forms, they don't mark that they are not the followers of any of the four major religions, Islam, Baha'i, or Judaism, or if they pretend that they are the followers of any of them, they can go to university. But because they are so persistent and they stick to their values, the Iranians feel much more threatened by them.
Okay, this is also a follow-up to the question on religion. The Ayatollah Khomeini was obviously motivated by religion. Now, from what you've said, it sounds like Khomeini is more interested in power than in pursuing religion. But how do you see him from a religious standpoint, Khomeini?
You're absolutely right. Khomeini had the religious standing to have that religious ideology as well. But Khomeini does not even have that religious standing. And he's been even marginalized. The senior clerics in Qom, they cannot even see him as a man that they have to follow, even though he has he controls their financial resources. So it's very humiliating for even senior clerics in Qom to sort of follow a man who is much more inferior to them religiously and in terms of his education.
Well, let's get into power politics in Iran. To what extent has Ahmadinejad been marginalized? Is he relatively powerless? Is he going to make a comeback? What's his future look like?
He has never had a big support base in the country. He was popular because he was giving out handouts. So if it comes to another elections or really a competition for power in public, I am not sure how much support he will have. One thing that is very is a good example of how he has been marginalized, I think, is over his influence over the intelligence ministry and foreign ministry. After he tried to dismiss both ministers, which he successfully dismissed the Minister of Foreign Affairs while he was on a trip, he humiliated him and dismissed him. Khamenei was the one who reinstated a new one, Ali Akbar Salehi, who used to be Iran's nuclear negotiator. And it seems like since Mr. Salehi has been appointed as foreign minister, Ahmadinejad has not been making any inflammatory comments anymore and has not tried to influence the foreign policy anymore. That's one thing. And the other one, his influence over the Ministry of Intelligence, he tried to dismiss the Minister of Intelligence again in May. Khamenei intervened and he reinstated the same minister. Ahmadinejad was not on talking terms with the minister until just last week, because the elections are coming up, the parliamentary elections are coming up. A lot of his allies are running for that election, and he went and paid a visit to the intelligence ministry. So I think he has been quite marginalized.
This questioner has said that he's heard that Khamenei is going to abolish the position of president. Is this true? How will Ahmadinejad react to that?
Well, if he does it, he's going to do it through parliament. Mm-hmm. And Ahmadinejad does not have much influence over parliament. He has some allies in parliament, but the majority are Khamenei's yes-mans, including the Speaker of Parliament. And Khamenei is not a kind of man who would talk about something without having thought it through and planned it. So since he talked about it, it seems that it is possible. It's something that he's considering seriously. And this is the direction that he's leading the country. This is the path that he has defined.
Well, this gets into the back to what you were talking about in 2009, the protest movement with, 3 million people in Tehran alone. If he were to abolish the presidency, would there be stronger protests? Any protests, or are the people so controlled now that they can't even protest?
Well, that's the $1 million question: how society will react? Would there be another spontaneous reaction? I must say that people who have been in Iran, journalists, diplomats, never saw any of them coming. Not even 1997, mm-hmm. the election of Khatami. Iranians have been very unpredictable. When we thought they would react, when we thought there would be huge protests, there was nothing. And then at a time when you didn't expect it, it happened. So I don't know how society will react. But Iranian society is coming under extreme pressure. And the economic pressure was not there in 2009. And now that is being added, not just by the sanctions, but economic mismanagement. Iranians are becoming more and more frustrated. And, you know, the anger is not going to just evaporate. It's not going to go away. It's simmering beneath the surface. Then whatever happens next, if there's going to be a response, it's going to be more explosive. It's going to be much more dangerous. Everybody's hoping that change would come gradually, would be grass-rooted, and would be peaceful and nonviolent. But it's hard to predict.
But to a certain extent, to go back to your earlier point, that we really should lift the sanctions. If the sanctions are creating this kind of frustration and unrest, maybe there's a benefit to them.
I this is something that I talked about it last night as well. I'm sorry that I'm repeating what I said to some of you. But the sanctions are hurting civil society in terms of crippling them from communicating with each other, having building networks. And we're not talking about more like complicated sanctions on Iranian oil industry. We're talking about sanctions on technology, very, very simple technology. In 2009, a lot of people were relying on Skype to communicate. They were relying on the internet to do networking, to communicate. This week, the Iranian regime announced that people will not have access to World Wide Web anymore. They're coming up with a Chinese model with a kind of intranet. The sanctions had deprived people from buying Skype credits to talk together, to download software, even to protect their computers from hackers and viruses. Hmm.
Back to the protest. Should the United States, and this is a two-part question, should we have played a more active role during the time of the protests in 2009? And if in the future protests erupt again, what should be our policy?
I don't think Iranians need any help. I don't think Iranians need any outside help. And if there is any kind of outside help, it can be used against people or the movement. It gives a good excuse to the regime to go out there and brutally suppress the protests again just by saying that they were getting support from outside the country. No, I think that just let them have what they need to have. Let them make, I mean, in the past decade, Iranians have been very successful in shaping public opinion, introducing people to democratic ideas, introducing people to ideas like respect for others, respect for human rights. It's something that came within a period of 10 years, and it wouldn't have been possible without satellites. It wouldn't have been possible without internet. There were all these journalists and activists who were producing ideas on the internet. Those ideas were being picked by satellite TV. It was magnified and broadcast to a larger audience. They've been exposed to these ideas, which are very valuable. You come across people who are not very literate, who are not very politicized, but they're familiar with ideas about civil society, human rights. They know what's happening to people in prison, to activists in prison. And these are very valuable mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Iran's nuclear ambitions. One questioner indicates that he's heard that Iran actually imports refined oil products, in which case maybe there's some justification for their nuclear program.
Not oil, refined gasoline. And that's because the consumption is so high. The vehicles that are produced in the country, they consume more. They're not very competent. But Iran actually gets oil from the Central Asian country in the north and swaps the oil. It even refines their oil, uses it for internal consumption, and exports in return for that refined oil in the south. No, they are refining oil. We have good refiners. I mean, their ability is dwindling. Their ability to excavate and get more oil out of ground is becoming more difficult with the sanctions. But that's why they lifted the subsidy on gasoline prices. Gasoline was being offered almost for free. The government was paying a huge subsidy. And that was part of the reason why consumption was so high. So they have tried to control the consumption, but the cars that they're producing in the country, they use so much more than an average Japanese car that they still have to import, and they still are.
In terms of their nuclearization, what's your best guess? Do you think they really intend to develop nuclear weapons? Or do you think their plan is just to get up to the threshold and stop? I mean, I know nobody knows the answer,
yeah.
but from your contacts in Iran, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, my guess is that the threshold is enough for them, mm-hmm. that the capability is enough. One thing is that Iranians have never been very competent with any projects. So I think their ability is being, unfortunately or fortunately for the outside world, because it's a rogue regime. I think what we know about their program so far is being highly exaggerated, and that is partly to keep Iran, the idea of Iranian regime as a threat. I think the Iranian regime is more of a threat to its own people than to the outside world at this stage.
So certainly then, to follow up, from your perspective, you don't believe that we should be launching an attack to prevent them from developing something that is unlikely they're going to develop?
That would be the most catastrophic thing that can happen and the best thing for the Iranian regime. Let's not forget that the war with Iraq solidified the Islamic Republic, and it turned into this radical ideological regime. They can use any kind of outside threat to galvanize all the forces behind a foreign enemy.
Okay, well, we're sort of moving into foreign policy. So the question is, what do you think Iran, with its, you know, focus on expanding its Shia strength throughout the Middle East, what is Iran going to do if Syria collapses? What influence do you think Iran is going to try to have in Iraq over the coming years?
Well, Syria would be a crucial place for them if they lose their grip there. Strategically, they will lose a major ally, and they will also lose the channel through which they were supporting their proxies elsewhere in Lebanon and in the occupied territories in Palestine, as they refer to it. In Iraq, I'm not so sure how much role they have. I hear from Iraqi friends that Iraqis, even Shiite Iraqis, are very skeptical towards Iranians. The Turks are doing so much better economically and are more engaged in development projects, so the Turks are much more popular. And even Shiites, Iraqi Shiites, who were in Iran for many years, and they are somehow, their children are have dual nationality, they're Iranians. Even they are quite skeptical, because Iranians have not been very constructive, have not played a very constructive role.
In terms of not religious but ethnic minorities in Iran, Kurds and others, is that an important problem, conceivably, for the Iranian Khomeini in the future?
Well, I think all the ethnic minorities, especially the Sunnis in the south, we have different Sunni ethnic groups. We have the Baluchis, we have the Arabs, and we have the Kurds. They are very, very frustrated, but they're not large. They don't even comprise 10% of the population. They are as frustrated as the rest of the people, and they do not have the ability to stage an uprising that would be threatening to the regime. If they join other forces, which they have in the past, that will become threatening for the regime.
Okay, we're going to wind down. We're going to switch to something that you've already referred to in your talk, and that is women's role in Iran. And you've explained what Khamenei thinks their role should be, but are women still involved in politics in Iran? Do they have much influence?
I think women are the most important foundation for democracy in Iran. the revolution, education, the new the information revolution, everything has helped them to become a really powerful force. Since the mid-90s, they started going to universities. Since 2000, women have built more than 60% of the university students who are getting accepted to universities. That means in the past decade, there have been more women coming out of universities with higher education than men. And in 2009, they had a dominant presence at the protests. Any picture that you see there are more women out on the streets than men. And after the government suppressed the protests, and women were still out there, and they're still out there. They came up with these very, very creative ways of expressing dissent. They started their websites to write love letters to their husbands who were in prison. And this is quite revolutionary for a traditional society where culturally women are not encouraged to express their feelings, especially about love to their husbands. And this has become very important because it's happening at a time when newspapers are being shut down and people don't have a way of finding out what's happening to activists in prison, and activists in prison have no idea what's happening inside prison. So women are writing these love letters to their husbands in prison. They're informing them what's happening outside, and they are posting these love letters on their websites, which is telling people what's happening to men. And there have been other smaller movements and campaigns, like one woman asked everybody on Facebook to wear headscarves in support of a student that the regime claimed was arrested wearing women's clothing, headscarf, to escape arrest. And thousands of men, even here in the United States, Iranian men, university professors, they changed the picture on their Facebook and they posted a picture of themselves with a headscarf. So they have been behind those kinds of campaigns as well.
Okay, last question. This may be a little bit unfair, but it's an interesting question. And that is, if from the sounds of what you have, from what you have been talking about, it sounds like the administration, Khamenei, doesn't have much support. He's got the Revolutionary Guard, the Basij. You've got the women, you've got the minorities, you've got a whole bunch of people that are against the regime. What is your prediction? I mean, what's going to happen in the future? How long can the regime last?
Well, I never dare to make that kind of prediction. absolutely. I mean, I think if regime had a good support base, it wouldn't have gone to these lengths to suppress dissent. I mean, they are afraid of even people close to the regime. They're afraid of their children. I remember before the 2009 election, the conservatives were saying themselves that they knew out of the 47 eligible voters, they had 10 to 15 million votes that they could mobilize. So the regime does not have a lot of ideological supporters anymore. Khomeini had a lot of people who had convictions. But this regime has people who have interests, have economic benefits in the status quo, and nothing beyond that.
I must say, I don't know when I've learned as much in an hour. I mean, it's been a fascinating talk. I'm absolutely appreciative of everything you've done. And as a reward, we're going to give you something that I hate to say this, Nazila, but you're not the first person in Cambridge to have this. But everybody in Cambridge wants one, and I'm really glad we're giving you one.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's the famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations Cup.